This is side two of the interview with David Trask at his home, April 28th, 1989. All right, well.
There were tremendous, of course, the ideological divisions of the time reflected themselves in the fact. And over time, these became more and more, the divisiveness became greater and greater. And people, it became, there were a lot of divisions.
Even
the
within
the
your
faculty had been, by the first kind of relatively small and relatively
homogeneous.
People got along with each other, everybody knew everybody. Over time, and of course, part of the difficulty was with a growing faculty, but it was, it divided up on political lines and on who knows on what other bases, and but particularly on political lines. And it made life increasingly uncomfortable and unpleasant.
Mm. Well, that's too bad.
For many people. Particularly if you were in positions of leadership, because you were constantly being buffeted.
Mm-hmm.
It was difficult. At this point, something happened that I think was a great mistake, which was the introduction of elected chair. I took the view that the chair was the lowest level of administration and was an administrative role, and loyalty was to the administrative chain.
Yes.
That obviously the chair of a department had a program had to reflect the interests and the feelings of the people, make these known. But I felt that the basic direction policy had to come from the administration, and that the role of the chairman to execute that direction, not to, if his department opposed something, simply be an interferer. I had an old-fashioned notion about the role of that chairman here, and the elective chairman principle, of course, turned the chairman into an out-and-out advocate of whatever the prevailing politics was of the department, and I think that was a serious mistake. But it was inevitable. Nothing could be done about it, I realized. But the administration, increasingly less able to, gave up on this one, sort of, I think, tended to propitiate chairs. So, but I really don't know what happened after that, because I got out of the network, and not really sure what happened much after 1970 or 1971. I remained as chairman, but I was gone.
When did you leave?
I left in 1976, but my last year as chairman was 1973-74. But I was one of the few chairs who sort of spanned the whole unrest period. Though I had a very long tenure relative to, by comparison with most people. And it was at the beginning, the middle, and the end of the whole, the real outburst of difficulty. I felt that the two great things that agitated the students were the drug question and the draft question.
Yes.
And that most of the student protest was really related to drug culture and to the distaste for the draft.
And
that
and the Vietnam
Stony,
War.
The Stony Brook students weren't really radical students. They were very, with the exception of very few, most of them mixed up kids like Peter Adams and people of that sort. With the exception of a few mixed up kids who thought they were revolutionaries, most of the students who participated, most of the students didn't really, weren't activists. They were simply going along. The Stony Brooks, the activist group was a very small group and a relatively ineffective group. I think Stony Brook came out of a lot better in a lot of places simply because, ironically, the absence of real leadership types in the student body had something to do with the ultimately the ineffectiveness and the fading out of undue student militants.
Well, I think a lot of the students had parents behind them who were pushing them to get ahead, and they didn't have time to do anything but study and go along the lines that their parents projected.
That's right. I think that's fair. Most students who came there to get a degree, and they were thinking in terms of advancing up the scale in America, like moving on beyond the level of their parents.
That's right.
They were rather less sensitive to political but the two things it obviously did influence was the drug business, which was much more pervasive than I would have believed, and of course the draft business. Once Nixon went to the volunteer system, the volunteer army principle, political protests stopped. I think this was true a lot of that Stony Brook. The two political issues were drugs and drug. And when the drug thing sort of got subsumed, and when the draft ended, that pulled the rug out from under, so that the Stony Brook became a very tame and rather inactive place from a student point. With a little bit of a bubble here and there, but really not much. As far as I can see, my knowledge isn't complete. It's remained there. Mm-hmm. It's been a relatively quiet campus.
Well, what do you hear about it now? Do you hear anything about it?
I don't hear much about it. Obviously, Stony Brook was very well talked about, and recruited the whole, so many people came there. But it's clearly the whole business of becoming the center of the system, as Berkeley was in California. The Berkeley of the East business gave Stony Brook a lot of notoriety, and some of those early faculty appointments, C.M. Young and so on, and that attracted attention. After President Toll left, there clearly, perhaps he left because he got caught up to by Albany, but surely as long as he was there, he kept us ahead. We were ahead. But it stopped. That is to say, whatever happened, that is to say, Stony Brook's privilege and special position was taken away. And maybe this was probably inevitable. I don't think that Stony Brook has anything like the. It's certainly a well-known, known place, but it doesn't have the position of leadership. Or it isn't thought of as an outstanding place in the way that we were thinking about becoming, or wanted to become, or were building toward. It didn't happen.
Yes.
I don't think.
I think there are a number of reasons for it. The leadership was not in the central administration, and when Rockefeller left, the subsequent two governors have been disasters as far as any educational leadership is concerned. Wharton made an effort as the chancellor to get some freedom for the university system, and he got half a loaf at least, not all the recommendations of the commission. Freddie, I think, was the chairman of it, were implemented by the legislature, but some of them were. But the appointment system for getting people at the top is not the best. I know enough about the Harvard system of appointments to wish that we had it. We don't.
Well, I think that Stony Brook made a mistake. Back then, but everybody, you got all of these young people, and they promoted. Everybody got promoted. I managed to block two promotions in the history department, but if I'd have had my way, I'd have blocked three or four more other ones. They just simply politically couldn't get away with any more than that. But we promoted too many people. We promoted people who simply weren't good enough. Everybody got promoted. Now the university, everybody's growing old together. There's hardly any junior faculty. This is stultifying. I think this was a mistake. And of course, our administration, the people who ran the Stony Brook, the administration, condoned this. And they did everywhere. You can't blame anybody. But I think that it was a mistake. I think that only a minority of people in the history department should have been kept. I think if you're going to build an outstanding university, you have to have tremendously high standards. And I think we made a serious mistake by bending over, keeping so darn many people we shouldn't have kept. And they are, take the history department. When we first started, it was a very well-known history department. But the good people left. Francis Gordon. Vichy France that we did for Bob, people like this.
Not Miller.
No. Other people.
Morse.
Richard Morse is another one. Yeah. Of course, Stanley. Some of these people left for other reasons.
Stanley took his place.
Yes, that's right. Stanley took his place.
What kind of a job do you think Stan Ross did?
Well, I think he did a good job. He irritated a lot of people, and he wasn't a diplomat by any means. But I think that he was aggressive. He worked very hard. His job was to get faculty, and he got them. Stanley had, to me, a rather fuzzy philosophy and outlook about it. He was very circumspect as to what he thought about things, it seemed to me. Most people didn't have any, they read whether he had been rough on them or whether it was a personal issue.
Yeah.
Stanley never had, he didn't appear to take a position on many of the great issues, though I know he must have had them. And I knew Stanley pretty well, and I maintained my association. I had relatively regular, pretty regular contact in one way or another in the profession after he left Stony Brook, much more so than most Stony Brook people did.
What happened to him, you know?
Well, he went down to Texas.
Yes, I know that.
He rose in the administration there and became second in command, basically. Became provost.
Yes.
Then there was a tremendous... Then a woman became acting president, who had been one of Stan's allies, but they got into a row, and Stanley got purged.
Is that right?
He then became the director of that Latin America, very important Latin America program. So, did a lot of this later. That context that I had here. But that's what happened.
Then he became.
He spent several years trying to get himself a job for presidency. He applied for and got onto, I think, quite a few shortlists. As Alec did the same thing. Alec finally got a second. I was a partisan of Alec's, that I thought he should have been president. But this was because we'd gone through a lot together and we're good friends. So maybe there were good reasons for his not being president. But all this, the question of whether he would be president or not, was something came up after I'd left there.
Right.
But I was very disappointed that he would not be president. It seemed to me. He was the person who understood what was going on there and,
yes.
and could have sustained some of the, a lot of people objected to, they thought that Alec was simply a builder of things, that he wanted to build buildings. But I don't think so. He had to my way of thinking, he had a very clear, he had very high standards, a clear notion of what the university should become. He recognized that the arts and humanities side of the university needed development as well as the science. He was balanced in his outlook, and fair. I had a very high opinion of him, still do. And the success that he has encountered at Rutgers seemed to me to suggest that I was right about it. But I had a high opinion of most of the senior administrators that I lived with. That group in particular, all five of them struck me as get mad at them, disagree at times, but I never lost respect or admiration for any of that group, including Pellegrino, who I thought was a really unusual person.
Very unusual.
And his later achievements suggested that he was worthwhile person.
Very broad gauge person for medical.
Has had a very strong
impact. Yes. Well, anything else for the good of the order? Why did you leave?
Well, I'd always been interested in public life, public service. Wesleyan was that sort of a place. It mm-hmm. communicated a public philosophy.
Right.
The Public Affairs Center was founded while I was there. The notion of public service, of being a responsible participant in the workings of government, was something that I had absorbed as a student. And I've always sort of in and out. I had worked down at Yale, down at New Haven, mm-hmm. in the summer for this renewal agency when I was a faculty member. And when the opportunity to go down to join the State Department came along, you know, it was to me a very attractive something. But I don't think that
function?
I wouldn't have in ordinary circumstances done that. Yeah. I felt that I had run my course, that I own particular activities there. I had gone full bore. I had sort of used up all my political capital. What was left for me at Stony Brook was simply to sort of go into semi-retirement for the next 25 years. Because I'd used up my potential as a leader. I wanted to do some things. I enjoyed my time at Stony Brook. There are some rough periods, but I didn't leave it. Any kind of bitterness or any of that sort of thing. But I just felt that I had, you know, made my contribution there, that it would be a matter of just taking the money and running the rest of the way, that I wouldn't really be in on things. I wanted to be in on things. And then this opportunity came, and so I went. What I did at the State Department, I was the director of the Office of the Historian. I was the historian of the State Department.
I see.
It was a rather large program, a federal program, more responsible. Involved in a lot of activity during the Carter administration. And then I moved on to work to serve as the chief historian of the Army for the last 6 or 7 years. So I had I'm the only person I think to have been the head of two different major federal history programs. And I was one of the founding fathers of the so-called public history. And I had many opportunities to do things and be involved in activities that wouldn't have come my way, I don't think, at Stony Brook. But I passed Stony Brook by, or Stony Brook had passed me by, whatever. The moment of my usefulness had passed, and I left at a good time. I know a lot of people that I think wish they'd have done what I did.
That's it.
who are just waiting now for their retirement, who felt
Hugh Cleland?
Deprived. I haven't really seen Hugh very much up there. I haven't been stealing from Hugh since I left there. The people I know best, with whom I have a regular association, Bernard Simmel and John Pratt.
Those are the two people that I think I know best.
They were the people that we shared. We had kind of common views and outlooks on things, right, about the university particularly. And, I think both of them are kind of alienated, not by choice, but by circumstance. They lost politically, so we lost.
Yes, I see.
The moderates, in a way, lost. The other crowd won, and it's been uncomfortable for a lot of them. I think that the wounds and the memories of the late 60s, early 70s are very powerfully influence behavior now, still do. People don't forget.
Yeah, when I came, the conflict of the Oyster Bay days was still present. Still very much present.
That split was very evident when I came to, the difference between the factions, the faculty. But it was a low level type of split compared to the splits that came later on. Really over.
Did you by any chance know George Howe? He did the book on the African campaign.
And wasn't he one of the editors of the bibliography?
Could very well have been.
The one, the publication in 1960.
Could very well have been.
I did not know him, but I knew of him.
He's a cousin of mine by marriage.
Is that right?
I did the Empire State of War, World War II, for the New York State War Council, published in 49, which was the history of the organization of the state on the home front during the war.
I had a student who was going to do this, New York, the state of New York during World War II.
Really?
What happened to him?
What's his
he
name?
He left. I can't remember his name now. But he never finished his work. He was a very bright student. He got involved in something. Some other opportunity came. He left graduate school and went on. And I don't know what happened to him. I'm sure he was successful. He was very bright. But that was a very interesting subject. John Pratt, of course, is the New York historian.
Yes.
Teaches the course in New York history. But we were going to, his kid's name, first name was Jerry. Jerry, and this was an Irish name. He came from Iona College.
Well, I was appointed director of records at the end of the war. The War Council, of which the governor was chairman. And I had five field men under me. But we retired the records that were of historical values to all the state departments and 108 war councils.
Are they in the New York State Archives now?
The department's records are. And the special war activities, war bonds, salvage, those war efforts are also there. The War Council itself, its records are there. But the records of the local war councils are either in the case of New York's city and the municipal reference library, or elsewhere, where there was a chance that there was an existing organization that was of that had survival value. Either the county historian or the county a local historical society that was strong, or the clerk, the county clerk's office. It depended from place to place where the greatest historical interest lay, and there was considerable variation. But I interviewed a number of people, Governor Lehman, for instance, Levy, and a number of the department heads, and Senator Ives, by a stenotypist, but a stenotypist at the time. So those things are there. Well, let's see. I think probably I ought to be going along. Thanks very much for being willing to sit still and go through this with me.
Brings back interesting memories. It's amazing what I don't remember.
Yes,
so much I forget.
Right. I've got to do this sort of thing for myself for the year 62, 65. I haven't done it yet, but I will.
Are you planning to interview John Pratt?
I certainly should.
I think he would be a very interesting source
I certainly
of
should.
Information.
Yes.
Right. He's been there since 1963.
63. I've interviewed
Bernard.
Someone, yes.
Did you have Hugh on that list? Hugh Cleveland?
Yes.
He's another one?
Yes, he was there. And I finally have interviewed Olson and Lee.
Martin Lee.
No. John Lee.
Oh, John.
The first president.
President.
I interviewed him in San Diego. And I interviewed Olson in Wilson, North Carolina.
That is an